Hey, today we're going to take a look at an application of trees. The trees that we will be using today aren't binary trees, they're general trees. A node may have an unlimited number of children, and also the children of a node are not ordered. The problem we're going to study today, called the union find problem, will not only use arbitrary trees, but will also make use of the simulated pointer representation that we talked about many weeks ago. Okay. All right, so first let's take a look at what the problem is. As I said, it's called the union find problem. And in this particular problem, we are given a set of numbers, 1 through n. And when we start this problem, each number or each of these n elements is in a different set. So the starting configuration has n sets, one element per set. Okay. And then starting from this initial configuration, we are to process a sequence of union and find operations where a union operation combines two sets into one. And it is kind of a destructive union, which means that after you perform the union, the two sets that you started with vanish, only the result of the union remains. So for example, starting with this initial configuration, if we had to union this set which contains 1 and that set that contains 2, following the union, I'd get a single set that contains both 1 and 2. The input sets, this one with 1 in it and that one with 2, are no longer part of the collection of sets. Okay. So it will always be the case that each of the n elements will be in exactly one set at any time. Okay. All right. Another way to say that is that our sets are disjoint, so no two sets will contain the same element. And of course, every element is in at least one set. Okay. The find operation is going to identify the set that contains a given element. So for example, we may be asked to find the set containing the element 3, or the set that contains the element 9, or the set that contains the element 20. Okay. All right, so to repeat, we are to come up with a representation for a collection of elements. A collection of n elements numbered 1 through n. These elements will reside in sets, and we are to be able to perform unions and finds upon these sets. Okay. Now, since a union will decrease the number of sets by 1, so if you union this set with that set, the number of sets goes down from n to n minus 1, it's clear that the maximum number of unions you can process is actually n minus 1. After that, all of your n elements will be in a single set. Okay. Now, we aren't going to talk about applications for this problem today. Several applications are discussed in the text, and I'm going to let you read those applications from there. Rather, we're going to just proceed with coming up with a data structure to represent these sets and to perform the union and find operations. Okay. All right, first, as with any other problem, we might try to solve the problem using structures we are aware of. For example, we may try to use arrays and chains to represent our sets. Now, this avenue is explored in section 7.7 of the text, and we aren't really going to go and look at the details of how arrays and chains can be used here. Rather, we'll take a look at the complexity that results when you employ arrays and chains. Now, in looking at the complexity, unlike other structures we've seen so far, where we have focused on the time it took to perform an individual operation. So, for example, we might have been concerned with the time to add an element to a list or the time to remove an element from a list. In the union find application, we are concerned with performing a sequence of union and find operations, and rather than be concerned with the time it takes to perform a single union or a single find, we'll be concerned with the time it takes to perform an entire sequence of unions and finds. So some variation in how we measure complexity here. Okay. All right, now, using arrays and chains, the best complexity that was obtained in section 7.7 of the text is n plus u log u plus f. U is the number of unions in that sequence of unions and finds, and f is the number of finds. And as I said earlier, the number of unions cannot be more than n minus 1, and therefore this is really the same as saying that your complexity is n log n plus f, where f is the number of finds. Okay. Now we'll see that when we employ a tree to represent our sets, we can cut this complexity down. We can look at this as really under the assumption over here that the number of unions is at least n over 2, and of course number of unions cannot exceed n minus 1. This thing works out to be n log n plus f, but using trees, we'll be able to bring it to n plus f. So you'd remove essentially a log n factor from this analysis here. Well, let's see how we might represent a set as a tree. Okay. All right, consider this set S that has 7 elements in it. Right, here's a possible representation of that 7-element set as a tree. There's one element in the root, doesn't matter which one. In this case, we've put the element 4. And then the remaining 6 are children of the root. Okay. So that's a possible tree representation for that set. Another possible tree for that set is this yellow tree out here. This time we've put 13 in the root, and it's got 2 children, a 4 and a 5, and so on. It kind of looks like it's a binary tree because each node has at most 2 children. However, if we stipulate that we don't care about the order in which the children appear, then it really is not a binary tree, but a general tree. Okay, another possible representation here has one child per node, and each node contains one element. Okay. All right, so essentially any tree that has 7 nodes in it is a candidate to represent our 7-element set. And then the elements can be placed in that 7-node tree in any fashion you like. Okay. All right, so a set may be represented in a tree that has as many nodes as the number of elements in the set. Any tree satisfying this property is a valid tree for the representation, and any mapping of the elements to the nodes in this tree is a valid mapping. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at how we'll perform our union find operations using this tree model or this tree representation. First, we want to take a look at the find operation. In the find operation, you're given the element that you want to find. So I want to find the set that contains element 10, for example. Okay. And now the question is, well, what does it mean to find the set that contains element 10? What should the find method return? Okay. Your initial answer to this might be that, well, maybe every set has some kind of identifier. And so if somebody says find 10, I return the identifier associated with the set, or maybe the name of the set. Now, it turns out that in most applications of the union find problem, the sets don't have any names associated with them. And our only requirement is that when you do a find, you return something unique about the set. And so a find needs to satisfy the condition or requirement that if I do a find on 2 elements I and j that are in the same set, then the find should return the same value. If I do a find on 2 elements I and j that are on different sets, then these two finds should return different values. Okay. So in applications of the union find problem, finds are performed basically to answer the question, are elements I and j presently in the same set, or are they in different sets? And so my find operation needs to simply return something unique about a set. This something unique needs to be such that different sets return a different unique quantity, and elements that are in the same set result in their finds returning the same entity. Okay. All right, so if you look at our first tree for that seven-element set, okay. So if somebody was to come in and say find 2 or find 9 or find 4 or find 30, then I should return the same value. On the other hand, if someone says find 2 and later says find 3, I should get back different values. The value that we're going to return is the root element of the tree. Okay. So find 2, find 9, find 4, find 13, all will return the value 3. Will return the value 4. The element 3 is not in this tree, presumably it is in some other tree. And if you did a find 3, you would return the root of that tree, and that would be different from 4, because 4 cannot be in any other tree. Okay. All right, so our convention will be that find returns the root element of the tree containing the element that you're searching for. Okay. All right, so the strategy to find an element then becomes, if somebody says find 9, then I will first have to get to the node that contains the element 9, and then from here I will climb up the tree to the root and say the answer is 13. Okay. Similarly, if somebody said find 30, I would get to the node that contains 30, then I'd climb up the tree until I reach the element which is at the root, namely 13. Okay. All right, so the strategy is fairly straightforward. Find the node for the element I, and then climb up the tree to the root, return the element in the root. Now, in order to implement this strategy, we must be able to do several things, like first you need to find the node that contains the element, and then you need to be able to climb up the tree. The second of these, climbing up the tree, is easily done if your tree has parent pointers. Okay. And so our tree structure, in fact, will be one in which each node has a parent pointer. Okay. That enables us to climb up the tree. Okay. Similarly, in this tree here, if you did a find 10, you would use some way to get to this node that contains 10, then follow the parent field here to get here, follow the parent field out here, then the parent field here would probably be a null, which tells you there is no parent. Okay. And then you could return the element 7 as the root element. Okay. All right, now before we examine the first of the two questions, recall there were two questions here. One was, how do you find the node that contains the element? And the second was, how do you find the root following the starting from the node that has the element I? So to find the root, we're going to use parent pointers. We still have to address the issue of how do we find the node that contains the element I. Okay. Now, before examining the question of how we find the node, let's take a look at node structures for our tree that has parent pointers. Okay. Right. The first possibility is to use nodes that have two fields, where the fields are the element and the parent field. And then, to answer the first question, how do we find the appropriate node, we can set up a table where the table has pointers to the nodes that contain the associated element. Okay. All right, so let's see what this looks like in terms of pictures. Okay. All right, so here's our yellow tree with the elements and the parent pointers in place. Then we're going to have a table, and this is a table of pointers where the ith entry will tell us which node contains element I. Okay. So since the elements are numbered 1 through n, table 0 will have no value in it, so be null. But table 1 will be a pointer to this particular node over there. And similarly, table 4 will point to the node that contains element 4. Table 9 points to the node that contains 9, and so on. Okay. Right, so the mode of operation then is if someone says, find one, I would go to table one, follow this pointer, which will get me to this node. Then I'll follow parent pointers from here until I reach the root and return the value 19. If someone says, find 9, I would go to table 9, follow the pointer here, get to this node, and then follow parent pointers to the root. Okay. All right, so that's one way to do the implementation. An alternative is to go into simulated pointers, which are just integers, make use of a one-dimensional array called parent, and parent of I is the parent of the element I. Okay, let's see what that means. Okay. So here is the tree. Okay, and to represent this tree, I'll make use of a one-dimensional array parent. So actually, I won't be keeping this yellow structure around anymore. I'll have only this one-dimensional array of type int. And each entry here will be a pointer to the element which is the parent. Okay. So for example, the parent of element 1 is element 2. Okay. So here I keep 2. Okay. All right, then the parent of 2 is 9. Okay. All right, 3 is not in this tree, it's in some other tree. 4 is in the tree. Parent of 4 is 13. Parent of 5 is also 13. Okay, 6 is not in this tree, 7 is not, 8, and then 9. Parent of 9 is 4. Then we go to element 11. Parent of 11 is 5. And then we have, I guess, number 13. And 13 has no parent, so I'll put in the value 0. Okay. All right, so this tree is actually represented in this fashion, where parent pointers are integers, and the integers actually point to some other place in the array, and that place in the array also corresponds to the element. Okay. So now, for example, if I had to find the root, well, if somebody came in and said, find element 1, I would start here at position 1 of my array. Parent 1 is a 2, so I'll come over here. Parent 2 is a 9, so I go to position 9. Parent 9 is a 4, so I go to position 4. Parent 4 is a 13, I go to position 13. Parent 13 is 0, which tells me this is the root of the tree, and so I return the last position in the array, 13. Okay. All right, so I essentially employ simulated pointers or integers to represent this tree structure in a one-dimensional array. The simulated pointer representation is a fairly simple one in this case. I don't need all of the infrastructure that was there for a general simulated pointer scheme. I don't need to have a notion of getting a node and freeing a node and so on here. I simply have a one-dimensional array, and I make use of these parts in the array to store the pointers. Okay. Okay, so that gives me a simple representation. It saves me a lot of space. I just have that one-dimensional array called parent. In the previous case, I had a one-dimensional array called table. In addition to that, I had my tree. So I've essentially done away with the explicit tree here, okay, saving a considerable amount of space. Okay, all right, now that we've seen the find operation, let's take a look at how the union operation is going to work. Okay. All right, in the union operation, we're going to be given two sets to union or unite, and we're going to make the assumption that the two sets are specified by their roots. So if somebody comes and says union I, comma j, I and j are the roots of two trees, and these trees are known to be different, so it's assumed that I is not equal to j. Our code is not going to check whether I and j are equal. It's guaranteed that they, in fact, are not equal. Okay, so I've got two trees. I know their roots. I want to make them into one tree. I simply make one tree a subtree of the other. Okay. And that could simply be done by changing the parent value of j, which is currently 0, because j is a root. I change it to have the value I, so it points to some other root. Okay. To see how this works, I have my yellow tree and I have my orange tree, and I'm asked to union 13 and 7. Oh, I guess in this case, I'm asked to union 7 and 13. Okay. So union IJ is union 7 and 13, and I simply have to make one a parent of the other. Okay. So I have to basically set a pointer from one root to the other, and in this case, if I say parent of J, which is 13, so parent of 13 equals I, which is 7. Okay. So I'm setting this blue pointer here, and that makes the yellow tree a subtree of the orange tree. Okay. All right, so to perform a union, I simply change one parent value and have it point to the other root that's given. Okay. Now, looking at the codes, the code for the find method then becomes, if you want to find the element, so long as you're not at the root, which means that your parent value is not 0, you move one level up, and then in the end you return the parent. You return the root at which you end. Okay. So the time required for this depends upon the level at which the element is in the particular tree it happens to be in. In the worst case, the amount of time would depend upon the would be equal to the height of the tree that contains the element. Okay. Code for the union method is simply change the parent of root B so that it is the root of the first tree. Okay. Right, it's not hard to see that the complexity of the union method is order 1. You just change one parent value. The complexity of the find method depends on the height of the tree. And unfortunately, the height of the tree could be equal to the number of elements that we have in the tree. Okay. In particular, if starting from the initial configuration of one element per set, we were asked to perform this sequence of unions, then the first union would result in parent of 1 being set to 2, so we'll have this tree. The second one would result in parent of 2 being set to 3. The third one would result in parent of 3 being set to 4, and so on. Okay. So we were going to end up with, in this case, a left-skewed tree, or in general, I guess we have a tree where each node has a degree of 1, and the height of the tree equals the number of elements. Okay. So now if somebody was to come in and say, well, find 1, okay, the time required to find 1 would be equal to the height of this tree, which is of the same order as the number of unions that was performed. Okay. All right, so if you get a sequence of U unions and F finds, we could find ourselves in a situation where the U unions take order U time and the finds take U times F amount of time for an overall complexity of U times F. Of course, U cannot be more than N minus 1. All right, so the result, if we factor in the time for initializing the parent values as the initial configuration, works out to n plus u times f, and we can see that this solution isn't as good as the solution obtained using arrays and chains. And in fact, if you look at the worst case tree is a chain. Okay, if you come back and look at the picture we had a little while ago out here, the worst-case tree resulting from a sequence of unions ended up being a chain. Here's the front of the chain, and here's the last node in the chain. Okay. All right, so this solution isn't as good as the solution obtained earlier in Chapter 7. Okay, so it's kind of back to the drawing board. We need to think a little bit harder and come up with a better solution that employs trees. Okay, so to come up with a better solution, we're going to re-examine both the union and find operations and see if perhaps we can perform the union and find operations in a somewhat more intelligent fashion than we are performing these at present. First, we're going to start with the union operation. Let's see if we can put some smarts into the union operation so that the performance becomes better than the performance we currently have. Okay. All right, so let's look at our two trees. We've got the yellow tree and we have the orange tree. And we have actually a choice. We could either make the yellow tree a subtree of the orange tree. That's what we did in the example that we looked at a little while ago. We said parent of 13 equals 7. Or we could make the orange tree a subtree of the yellow tree. Okay. Now, given this choice, we might now start to stare at these trees and try and see if it makes any difference which way we go. Previously, we didn't care. We just said the second tree specified, namely the one root 13, becomes a subtree of the first tree, which is 7. Okay. Now, we could reason that the height of a tree is important. If we could keep the height small, then the time for a find would be less. Okay. So if we reason that it's desirable to have trees of small height, then we could examine the height of these two trees and say, well, the yellow tree has a height that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the orange tree has a height that is 4. Okay. If I made the yellow tree a subtree of the orange tree, the new tree would have a height that is 6. If I made the orange tree a subtree of the yellow tree, the new tree would have a height that is 5. So, rationalizing that trees of a small height are desirable, I could make the orange tree a subtree of the yellow tree in this case, thereby creating a tree whose height is 5 rather than one whose height would be 6. Okay. Alternatively, I could say, well, it's if I make the yellow tree a subtree of the orange tree, then there are 3, 5, 7, 8 elements for whom the cost of a search becomes one unit larger because each of these end up at a lower level than they presently are. On the other hand, if the orange tree is made a subtree of the yellow tree, okay, then there would be 4, 5, 9, 10 elements whose cost for a find would go up by one each. So when the yellow tree becomes a subtree of the orange tree, there are 8 elements for whom the cost of a find will go up by one each because each one drops one level in the tree. And if you make the orange tree a subtree of the yellow tree, well, then there are 10 elements which suffer a one unit penalty per find. So since I'm worried about the cost of a sequence of finds, I might opt then to make the yellow tree a subtree of the orange tree, incurring a one unit additional penalty on the yellow nodes, but no additional penalty on the orange nodes. Okay. All right, so there seem to be two ways to reason here. One is to try to keep the height small, in which case the orange tree would become a subtree of the yellow tree. And the other one is to keep the number of nodes at higher levels small, total number of nodes at higher levels small, in which case we would make the yellow tree a subtree of the orange tree. All right, so these two lines of reasoning lead to two different rules for union. One is called the height rule, which simply says make this tree with smaller height a subtree of the other one. Okay. As we saw in this case, we would make the orange tree a subtree of the yellow tree. This has a height of 4, that had a height of 5. The new tree has a height of 5. All right, so using the height rule, the height changes only when you union two trees of the same height, then the new tree has a height one more than the starting height. Okay. All right, the other one was the weight rule. The tree with the smaller number of elements becomes a subtree of the other. And in our example, the yellow tree becomes a subtree of the orange tree. To implement these rules, the root of the tree needs to record either the height of the tree or the number of nodes or elements in the tree. And once you have that, you can then perform the union by first comparing the recorded value in the two roots and then appropriately choosing which tree becomes a subtree of the other. Now, if you use either the height or the weight rule, it turns out you get the same bound on the worst case height of a tree. Okay. So even though the weight rule wasn't designed to specifically reduce the height, it has the effect of bounding how high these trees can get. And that bound on the height is the same as the bound you get when you use the height rule. Okay. So you can show that a tree that has P nodes in it, or P elements in it, will have a height that is at most log of P plus 1, regardless of whether you use the height rule or the weight rule. Okay. All right, so this immediately improves the worst case performance of the union find algorithms. Previously the height could be P, now the height is only log P plus 1, and so the cost of a find reduces from the number of unions performed, which was could be as much as n minus 1, to log of the number of unions performed. Okay. Right, we aren't going to go through the proof here. You can check it out from the book. Let's turn our attention now to the find method, see how we can maybe spruce this up to give us a better performance. Okay. Now, recall when you do a find, you kind of start at the node corresponding to the element you want to find. So if you're doing a find one, you'd start out here, and you march up the tree, okay, and then you return the value 7. Okay. Now, you pretty much have to do that work. I mean, there's no way starting from here you're going to end up with 7 as the answer unless you march up the tree one node at a time. What we're going to do in sprucing up the find is we're actually going to do additional work. So instead of just saying, I'm going to come and once I found the answer is 7, I'm going to walk away, I'm going to come and do some added work so that future finds become cheaper. Okay. And the added work is aimed at compressing the path from 1 to 7. So this path that you followed to find 7 as the root, we're going to compress this path, make it shorter, so that the next time you come to find the element 1, you don't have to walk up as many lengths. Or when you come to find 2, you don't have to walk up as many links as you otherwise would have to do. There are several strategies for compressing the path from 1 to the root. Let's take a look at these. The first of these we'll call path compaction. And in this, every node encountered on the find path will be moved so that it becomes a child of the root. Okay. So we will change the pointer, the parent pointer in node 1, as well as node 2, node 9, and node 4, so that they all point to the root 7. Okay. Path compaction is implemented so that you start with node 1, you follow all the way up, you find the root 7, and then you make a second pass where we change the parent pointers. Okay, so we change that parent pointer so that it points to the root. Then I come to this node, I change that parent pointer so that it points to the root. I change this parent pointer so that it points to the root. Okay, and we come here, we change this parent pointer so that it points to the root. Okay, so after path compaction, all of the pointers encountered on your first pass, which was required to find the root, all of them are reset so that they point to the root. The net result of this is that when subsequently you come to perform certain finds, like find one, instead of having to walk up 3, 4, 5 lengths, you have to walk up only 1 link. If you come and look for some element in the subtree B, you have to look 1, 2, 3, 4 links fewer. Because once you come to node 1, you then short circuit all the way to the root by passing these 4 links. Similarly, if you come to look for somebody in the subtree E, you bypass those 2 links and you go straight up to the root, saving 2 pointers. Okay. So by compacting this path, we impact the cost of a find for potentially a huge number of nodes, all the nodes in the subtrees A, B, C, D, E, F, G, as well as the nodes 4, 9, 2, and 1. The cost of finds there all become somewhat cheaper. All right, so we do this added work. The cost of this individual find goes up because we're changing a bunch of pointers we didn't need to change. Okay. But we do this with the expectation that there will be many more finds done down the road, and the cost, the added cost we paid now, will be more than recovered by savings in the future finds. Okay. All right, now a deficiency in this approach is that it makes two passes up the tree. Okay. So there are two other ways to do path compression. Both of these do the compression using only one pass up the tree. Okay. The first of these, path splitting, as we are going up the tree looking for the root, the parent point in each node is changed so that it points to the grandparent of that node. Okay. So you have one variable which is two nodes behind the other, so maybe you have a variable out here called P, and you have a variable here called GP, the grandparent. So these two nodes move in a synchronous fashion, so GP moves up to 4 the next time, and P moves to 2, then GP will move to 13, and P will move to 9. Okay, so these two nodes always stay two behind. And as you go up, you change the pointer in P so that it points to GP. Okay, all right, so here we will change this pointer so it points to its former grandparent. We will change the pointer in 2 so that it points to its former grandparent. We will change the pointer in 9 so that it points to its former grandparent. We change the pointer in 4 so that it points to its former grandparent. The parent in 13 stays the same. It doesn't have a grandparent. It just points to its former and current parent. Okay. All right, so we change just as many pointers here as we did in the previous case of path compaction. However, I don't need to make two passes. I can make this sequence of pointer changes as I'm going up the tree in a single pass. Okay. All right, the second of the single pass schemes is called path halving, and this one only changes half as many pointers as the earlier single pass scheme did, path splitting. Okay. And to see the difference, as we're going up the tree, the parent of 1 is changed to 9. Okay. But we aren't going to change the parent of 2. We'll then go and change the parent of 9 so that it's at 13. We'll skip node 4. And then, of course, node 13 doesn't need any change. Okay. All right, so in path halving, you change half as many pointers. Okay. All right, all of the schemes have the same objective, which is to compress the height of the tree, at least along the path that was taken to do the find. The first of the schemes, which is the two-pass scheme, path compaction, does apparently a more effective job, at least on the example that we've seen here, in terms of path compaction. The other two schemes, splitting and halving, splitting doesn't make two passes, it's a single-pass scheme. Path halving is also single pass, but does only half the work. Okay. Now, it turns out that from the complexity standpoint, as we're going to see, at least from the asymptotic complexity standpoint, it doesn't really matter which of the three path compression schemes you implement. The worst case performance is the same from an asymptotic point of view. Okay. Now, to figure out the complexity of the scheme, it's a fairly difficult task. It's a very involved analysis, one that spans about 20 typed pages, strewn with a number of lemmas and so on. We're going to skip the analysis and just give the result. And just to give the result actually is going to take about 5 minutes of time. So looking at the result, we need to first define a function called Ackermann's function. And this function is defined in the following fashion. It's a two-variable function, A, the variables or parameters to the function being I and J, where Aij has the value 2 raised to J when I is 1 and J is greater than or equal to 1. It's defined recursively when I is greater than or equal to 2 and J equals 1 in this fashion. And then you have a double recursion here for the case when j is at least 2. Okay. Now, in the analysis of the union find scheme with the smart union and find methods, we actually will employ the inverse of this function. Okay. And the inverse of the Ackermann's function, defined as alpha pq, is defined in the following manner. Now, one can show that the Ackermann's function is a very rapidly growing function. As you change the values of I and j, the value of the Ackermann's function goes up at a very, very rapid rate. In fact, the rate is so rapid that when I and j take on small values such as 2 and 4, the value of the Ackermann's function is 2 raised to 65,000. To get a feel for how big this is, consider the number of atoms in the universe. That's of the order of 10 to the 79, which in terms of powers of 2 is roughly like 2 raised to 300. Okay. So this number, compare that to 2 raised to 300. Okay. It's huge compared to the number of atoms in the universe. Look at the number of photons and neutrinos in the universe. That's like 10 to the 88. That's also about 2 raised to 300. So this is a huge, huge number, even compared to the number of atoms, photons, and so on in the universe. Okay. Now, if the Ackermann's function grows very, very rapidly, the inverse function grows very, very slow. Okay. So for example, one can show that the inverse function, pq, is smaller than 5, so long as the value of q is smaller than 2 raised to a41, and a41, okay, is bigger than a24, which is 2 to the 65,000. Okay. So for alpha pq to become 5, the value of q needs to be really, really large, much, much, much larger than the number of atoms in the universe. Okay. Now, that's important for our analysis, because in our analysis, q is going to be the number of elements. Okay. So unless we're trying to solve a problem where the number of elements is much, much, much larger than the number of atoms in the universe, the alpha value is not going to be 5. And of course, if we're trying to solve a problem that's that large, we aren't going to have the memory. Okay. It's going to take more memory than there is space in the universe to hold. All right, so for all practical purposes, we may assume that the value of alpha is smaller than 5. Okay. All right, the time required to process any sequence of F finds and U unions, where the number of unions is at least n over 2, is given by this inequality. The time is bounded from above by n plus some constant times alpha, and this we've seen is going to be at most 5, say, and bounded below by n times the number of finds times alpha. Okay, sorry, f here is the number of finds. So it's n plus the number of finds times an alpha, and here also it's n plus the number of finds times alpha, and then you have some leading constant coefficients A and B. Okay. From the practical point of view, what this means is that the time to process the sequence of unions and finds is bounded by n plus f. Okay. Since alpha is 5, so asymptotically it's just order of n plus f down here, and you have the same thing over here on the lower side, n plus f. From the theoretical point of view, it's really not linear in n plus f, because you have this alpha term, which at least theoretically would grow. At some point, n would be large enough that alpha would become 5. And then at some other huge, huge point, n would be large enough that alpha would become 6, and so on. Okay. So from the purely theoretical point of view, when you use the smart union and smart find methods, the cost of processing a sequence of unions and finds it is a little bit more than n plus f. Okay, there is some non-linearity in the f part, but for all practical purposes, the time is n plus f. Okay, I guess that's all that there is to this problem, and then next time we'll take a look at another type of tree. Okay, thank you.